It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin schools are trying to prevent bullying, but it's hard to tell what actually works. A state education official tells us why it's hard to keep track of bullying. First, take a second and think about the neighborhood where you live. Maybe it has apartment buildings or a few duplexes, or maybe it's a neighborhood made up entirely of detached, single-family homes. Turns out that for a lot of cities in the U.S., most of the residential land is zoned exclusively for single-family homes, and some cities and states are starting to change that in the midst of an affordable housing crisis. Emily Badger covers urban policy for The Upshot at The New York Times. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into what's going on today, can you talk a little bit about how we ended up with so much of our residential land zoned for only individual houses and, by the way, ones that don't bump up against each other?
Yeah, so single-family zoning is a 100-year-old idea in America. It really took off across the country after the Supreme Court gave the green light to local communities to adopt this in their zoning policies. And what we see sort of in communities all across the country starting in the 20s and kind of accelerating across the 20th century is that, you know, newer built sort of sunbelt suburban communities that were built sort of in the post-war period were entirely built around this idea that, you know, all of the residential housing should be detached single-family homes. Everything should be exclusively that. There should be fewer apartment buildings. To the extent that there are apartment buildings, they should be separated from single-family neighborhoods. But the other thing that we saw was that kind of older, denser cities downzoned repeatedly over the years. And that means that they effectively said that things that we used to build in the past are illegal now. You can't build them anymore. So if in the past you might have had a duplex, a small four-unit apartment building next to a single-family home, next to a triplex, a lot of communities effectively said, we don't want to build like that anymore. And it got to the point where, when we were looking at data in cities across the country recently this spring, you know, we see that in 75-80% of a lot of fairly large, including older cities in America, their residential land, that much of it is devoted exclusively to single-family zoning.
Right. You've got some very stark maps in your piece at The Upshot showing a variety of cities where, as you say, 70-90% is only this. It's very striking, didn't you think, to see that visually?
Yeah, I mean, even I was surprised by the extent of it. And I think that we tend to think, even people who are fairly sort of savvy about the topic of zoning, tend to think of single-family zoning as primarily a suburban issue. It's mostly suburban communities who say, you know, no thank you to apartment buildings. But in fact, you know, we saw 94% of the residential land zone single-family in San Jose, 84% of it in Charlotte, 81% of it in Seattle. So even in, you know, central cities, including some older cities, this is an idea that has really come to dominate how we think about neighborhoods.
There's some pushback you report, and we'll get into a couple specific examples in a minute, but why are people raising the red flag over this dominance of single-family housing as the way to zone communities?
So there are three different things that are happening at the moment that are all kind of converging right now. One of them is that particularly on the coasts, there are communities where they're having a housing crisis. The cost of housing is incredibly high. They're having a housing shortage, and they're struggling to find places to build more housing. And so in those communities, single-family zoning appears to be making it harder to build more housing. If we have set aside all of this land for nothing but detached single-family homes, you know, how are we going to fit more housing onto the land that we have? So there's the housing crisis on one hand. Then there is this increasing concern around the environment and climate change, that one solution to them, not the only solution, but one possible solution would be to build denser cities, to enable more people to live without cars, to not be as dependent on cars and the emissions that they produce. So a lot of communities are talking more about that than they ever have in the past. And then the third issue that came up in a number of cities we looked at was concerns about racial inequality that are really kind of baked into the fabric of how we have designed communities. So racial segregation in some communities has really been sort of buttressed over the years by zoning laws, by these maps that say that, you know, more affordable housing, multifamily housing will be sort of segregated over here, single-family housing and good schools will be segregated over here. So a number of communities like Minneapolis and Charlotte are very explicitly having a conversation about racial injustice when they're talking about getting rid of single-family zoning.
Emily Badger is with us. She covers urban policy for The Upshot at The New York Times. In a recent piece, she looked at single-family housing. It's the dominant zone in many communities, means that's the only thing you can build there. Some communities are pushing back and changing that now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the single-family detached, meaning not touching the house next door, should that be the mode, the perfect storm, the great thing that we want in all of our communities? Or do we need to allow, as some communities are, more development of duplexes, apartment buildings, and more? Call in at 800-642-1234. Emily, take us across Wisconsin's western border to Minneapolis. What's happening there?
So Minneapolis in December became the first major city in America to say, you know what, we're just going to stop doing this. We're going to take all of the lots that are designated single family in our city, and in Minneapolis this covers about 70% of their residential land, and we're going to say, okay, from now on you can put two units there or you can put three units there. They've effectively opened up all of these neighborhoods to building sort of very mildly denser housing. We're not talking about putting 10-story apartment buildings in these communities. But when they did this, it was really the sort of shocking thing because no other city like Minneapolis had done it on that scale before. And a lot of other communities started to say, oh, is this possible? How do we talk to the public about this? You know, there's tremendous opposition oftentimes from homeowners to this idea. And yet here is a large American city that managed to, with fairly overwhelming support of their city council, say, you know what, we're just not going to do this anymore.
An interesting point you reported on was that they did this everywhere in the city, whereas an approach in the past has been, oh, how about that neighborhood? And then that neighborhood might fight back. Oh, how about that neighborhood over there? They did it all at once. Did that address some of those local concerns?
Yeah, I mean, the much more typical way that cities grow more dense over time is that, you know, a developer would say, I would like to upzone this one parcel, or let's reconsider, you know, just this one corridor. And it would be done in this very kind of targeted piecemeal way. And Minneapolis basically said, we actually think that it will be easier to do the entire city than to have sort of targeted fights with individual neighborhoods, especially because there's this kind of history in communities across the United States, not just in Minneapolis, that the communities that have kind of the least political power are often the ones that get more density sort of pushed onto them. And, you know, typically whiter, higher income communities have greater capacity to push against this and say, no, we don't want this. So you have these inequities built into, just doing a little bit of upzoning here and there. And so Minneapolis said, no, we're just going to do it everywhere. And we hope that that sort of minimizes the fear that people have that all of the density is going to flow just into my community, or that you've picked my community and not another community.
Well, that's Minneapolis doing this a year ago. Now, fresh in the news, the state of Oregon just voted, I think it was yesterday, to change their laws. What happened there?
Yeah, so Minneapolis felt striking because this was an entire city doing this, and now Oregon has gone and sort of one-upped them by doing effectively this across an entire state. And so Oregon is the first state to ever do this. They passed a law yesterday, it still needs to be signed by the governor, that effectively says in every city of at least 25,000 people across the entire state of Oregon, duplexes are now going to be allowed on single-family lots. And every city larger than 10,000 people. And every city larger than 25,000 people, you know, they want to legalize what they call missing middle housing, you know, this sort of middling thing in between single-family homes and larger apartment buildings. So things like four-unit buildings, little kind of cottage clusters. And it passed there, you know, this is a fairly remarkable thing for a state to do, but it passed by a fairly comfortable margin and was supported by both Republicans and Democrats in their state legislature.
We're talking to Emily Badger from The Upshot at The New York Times about why more cities and now states are taking another look at single-family zoning laws and the role they're playing in a housing affordability crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a neighborhood that's all single-family houses? Do you like it that way? Or would you be open to things like duplexes or small apartment buildings? If you live in a neighborhood that's not all single-family units, what do you think of that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Emily Badger of the New York Times. She's with us to look at single-family zoning regulations in the U.S., how they affect housing costs, and why some communities are changing the rules. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like the idea that a lot of residential areas, especially in cities, are zoned single-family housing only? Or do you think that should change, some more density allowed, whether that's a duplex, a four-unit, or bigger? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you have trouble finding housing you can afford where you want to live? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Marcus is on the line in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I do remodeling and construction. I own my own company, and I work for six landlords. They have 103 units between them in Milwaukee and Waukesha County. I also went to UW-Milwaukee and studied political science and history, and I have 2442 credits done towards the Master's of Public Administration, so I've had classes on zoning and whatever else. This is a crisis that's going on around the country for affordable housing, and I think if they took and rezoned a lot of the family, like the single-family units, and said, you know, you can take and build out the upstairs of that Cape Cod and rent it or make it into a duplex, I think one of the ways that we could alleviate some of the concern of homeowners is if we were to take and change the law and say, yes, you can do that, but you can't be an absentee landlord. We want you to be an owner occupied for at least one of the units, but feel free to bring in some extra income and provide some more affordable housing.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. And I think, Emily, that came up a little bit in your piece, the idea of, okay, it's a single family house and you can rent out the room over the garage to Fonzie or whatever. Is that something you've seen communities work on?
Yeah, I mean, a somewhat less dramatic idea than literally saying we're going to rezone the entire city would be to pass a law, which some communities have done, Seattle is talking about doing this today, that would allow what are called accessory dwelling units. So this is something like a backyard cottage, an in-law suite, a granny flat, literally just telling single-family homeowners, you can stick a small second unit in your backyard, or you can turn your basement into one. And as Marcus alluded to, one of the benefits of this is that it doesn't fundamentally change what these neighborhoods look like if you're walking down the street. I mean, you may not realize that that house right there has a unit in the basement or it has a small unit in the backyard. So I think that's absolutely, you know, sort of a smart policy solution, and it's something that a lot of cities are talking about. And to say, you know, let's let people build accessory dwelling units sounds a little less dramatic of a change than saying we're going to upzone everyone's single-family neighborhood.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Becky with us now in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hey, I was just wondering how, well, aside from curb appeal, this would affect the property values of the homes that are, you know, could possibly be turned into these rental units or duplexes.
Becky, thanks a lot for the call. And Becky, Emily is hitting on a concern of a lot of people in neighborhoods that could be rezoned, right?
Yeah, this is a really, really excellent question that sort of sits at the center of a lot of debates about this idea. People are very fearful that changes to their neighborhoods, if they have a home in an existing single-family neighborhood, that their property values will decline as a result of this. But we really don't have sort of definitive data about what will happen in these communities in the future. You know, another way of looking at this is that if you own a home in a single-family neighborhood, the city is effectively sort of giving you a new property right in that they're telling you, now we're going to let you build another unit or build two units. And so in that sense, there's an argument to be made that actually this isn't going to lower your property value. It could potentially raise it because now you can do more things with your property than we allowed you to do in the past. But I think it will take some time looking back on a city like Minneapolis that does this at scale in order to really be able to say, what does this do to people's property values? And it's entirely possible that it just won't do very much to people's property values at all, because what we'll see is that, you know, maybe one duplex will go in, you know, on a block, or one four-unit apartment building will go in a neighborhood that's slightly larger than that. And that's really not going to be a very dramatic change, I don't think.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Emily Badger from the New York Times about zoning, single-family housing zoning. It's the dominant way of doing things in a lot of cities, a lot of communities around the country. Some cities and states are changing that. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Emily, we heard from Leslie on Facebook. Leslie says adding more people increases traffic. That's Leslie's concern. Do we see concerns about things like traffic and other infrastructure when we're increasing population density?
Absolutely. I mean, in every community where I have seen this debate play out, we have on the one hand people who are for higher density making very kind of sweeping arguments about making housing more affordable, making communities more fair, addressing climate change, righting kind of historical injustices. And then on the other hand, the people who are opposed to this are making much more kind of concrete quality of life objections. They are worried about whether or not they will be able to still park on their street, if their streets will become overly crowded, if their children's schools will become crowded, literally if the sewer system underneath these single-family neighborhoods will be able to handle the capacity of more people living there. So there's something of a disconnect in the debate that communities are having around this, and that on the one hand, a lot of people are worried about very, very concrete quality of life objections. And on the other hand, people are saying, well, you know, in order to achieve these bigger, more important goals in our community, perhaps, you know, we're going to have to make some concessions on some of those topics.
Let's go back to our callers now. Max is with us in Two Rivers. Max, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think that there should be kind of less focus on building, you know, suburbs and single-family homes in favor of building maybe 10-story, you know, apartment buildings that can fit many, many different families in just a fraction of the space. Because you see all the time, you know, they're clearing 100 acres of forest when you could just clear like 7, make the apartment building, and, you know, that 100 acres doesn't need to be gone just because you want to fit a suburb community in somewhere.
Max, thanks a lot for the call. Max echoes Jacqueline on Facebook, who says we should be building up, not out. Emily, that's one of the arguments in favor of this change, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of pro-environmental argument that single-family zoning has contributed to sprawl because it's meant that if we need to make room for more people, there's nowhere to build housing for them except on the periphery. And so, you know, the suburbs just keep moving farther and farther out into greenfield or into farmland. But the specific argument that a lot of people are making about these single-family neighborhoods is that, you know, it's insufficient to just build a lot of apartment buildings downtown. We really need to be creating more options in neighborhoods all across the city so that, you know, we're giving families with more moderate incomes a chance to go to a good school in an otherwise wealthy neighborhood, or we're giving families access to parks that primarily exist in single-family neighborhoods. There are some arguments for this that are not just about creating more housing supply, but specifically about dispersing it around the city.
Max, thanks for the call. Pat joins us now in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi, how are you? I live in the town of Three Lakes. We have 18 lakes on our chain of lakes in the town of Three Lakes. We basically have about about 100 mile of frontage, and we have a lot of single family residential homes. We determined we wanted single family residential homes about 30 or 40 years ago, so we'd have quiet neighborhoods. We have a lot of absentee owners now, and the state of Wisconsin, in its brilliance, decided that they'd eliminate zoning in the state of Wisconsin as far as single-family homes go. We used to have to have, if somebody wanted to rent in a single-family area, it had to be 30 days or more. Now they decided it was down to 7 days, and it doesn't give the neighbors any options to discuss the fact that now they're in a resort area where they used to be in a single-family residential area.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if you know the specifics here in Wisconsin, Emily, but Pat points to an important point. This could be a complicated network of local, maybe county, and definitely state laws, right?
Right, absolutely. I mean, in most states, zoning is up to the local community. It has fundamentally been an issue of local control across America going back, you know, all the way to the beginning of the 20th century. But there are certainly some places where the state exerts more control than it does in most parts of the country. So Oregon is an example of that, for instance. You know, they've long had these urban growth boundaries around their metro areas that say, you know, you cannot expand beyond this particular boundary because we want to prevent places from sprawling. We want to protect greener spaces outside of cities.
Thanks a lot for the call, Pat. Emily, one issue I wanted to get into before we run out of time. In Oregon, you reported that AARP was on board with these changes. Why would they be interested in this zoning change?
So they're on board with this because they would like the ability of older residents to be able to, quote, age in place. So this is the idea that as you get older, you know, you should be able to stay in your community where you have connections, where you have raised your children, where all of your friends are. You shouldn't have to necessarily move to a nursing home or an assisted living facility or something like that. And the idea that we talked about earlier of something like an accessory dwelling unit is particularly appealing to people who are concerned about aging in place because, you know, it creates this scenario where you could have multiple generations of a family occupy a property. You know, maybe your older parents come to live with you and occupy the unit in your backyard and families can take care of each other, or, you know, someone who is like a live-it home health aide could occupy a small unit in the backyard. So to them, that's a way of sort of converting housing to the housing that an older population is going to need without literally having to move them.
In our last minute or so, Emily, we've seen Minneapolis and Oregon. What parts of the country are you watching for that may make changes next?
Well, this is particularly hot on the West Coast because all of the issues that I mentioned are really converging right there, and they have a particularly dire housing crisis. But I also have heard from a number of cities that sort of surprised me that took a look at Minneapolis and said, oh, maybe we should be having a conversation about this too. So Charlotte, North Carolina, for instance, is a place where I would not have predicted they're having this conversation, and they're starting to have it there also.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Emily Badger of The Upshot with The New York Times. She was with us today to talk about why a number of cities, and in some cases states, are reconsidering single-family zoning laws, in part because of a crunch on affordable housing in many communities. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts and maybe your experiences with this. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what you think of these ideas. And if you have tried to buy or rent in your community and had trouble doing it, or if you're on the other end of things, a developer yourself or in city government, love to hear from you. Share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, bullying is a big issue in Wisconsin schools, but it's hard to get numbers on just how common it is. A state education official joins us for a look at efforts to track incidents of bullying and figure out what works to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, candidate Tony Evers said he supported cutting Wisconsin's prison population in half. Now that he's governor, we're finding out how difficult that could be. We'll talk about some of the roadblocks coming up. First, a 2017 CDC report found that more than 24% of Wisconsin students polled said they were bullied on school property during that year. Bullying has real and damaging long- and short-term effects, but it's hard to measure how common it is because different schools report it in different ways. That makes it tough for state officials to keep track of the problem and to figure out what interventions actually work. Beth Herman is an education consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's Student Services Prevention and Wellness Team. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Before we get into the difficulty measuring bullying, it seems like everybody's in agreement it is a serious problem that needs to be tracked, right?
Correct. And the 24% is a pretty consistent number nationally as well as state. So, the CDC is probably using their YRBS data. And we can make comparisons between statewide data and national data to see if we're actually in trend with that. So that 24% is pretty on target.
Why is it hard, though, for us to measure school by school how much bullying is going on?
Well, initially, part of the difficulty is in how we define that. So if we aren't all defining it the same way, we're measuring apples and then comparing them to oranges. So having a consistent idea of what actually constitutes bullying is really important. We get a lot of calls from schools and parents sometimes about situations that may or may not be bullying. Just because something is a violent act doesn't mean that it constitutes a bullying incident. So having some definition to make that consistent across areas would be helpful. But then also, depending on how you measure it, could actually have a greater impact on whether you're getting good information or not.
Do we have a good working definition of bullying that most people in the field agree on?
There are. So about 7 years ago, the international research community around bullying prevention actually came up with a definition so that when they do studies, they can compare these studies. Previous to that, you could have data from one researcher that you couldn't necessarily compare to another because they weren't measuring the same thing. So there is a definition. That's the one that we have on our website. And it pretty is consistently looking at having an imbalance of power in the situation, as well as a repetitive action and an intent to harm. So it's a little bit different than a general bullying situation.
Do schools report any kind of bullying statistics, regularly to either the state or the federal government?
Not at this time. They do need to report harassment data, but harassment is a little bit different. So if you were to look at that harassment data, it's not going to line up very well. And at this point, there's no legislative authority granting DPI the ability to collect that data from schools.
So the CDC data sounds like it's the best we have to work with, but does that really allow us to drill into local communities, say, and figure out how they're dealing with bullying?
It can. So, and in fact, that's probably a better measure because oftentimes people are looking at what we call frequency data. How many bullying reports is the school receiving? Generally, that's a formal process. At the very least, a student or a parent is communicating verbally to somebody, but generally it's a report form. But we know students don't report. Particularly when we get to high school, they aren't reporting to adults. So the CDC data using the YRBS actually gets to what we call perception data, or where students are indicating their experiences, but they're doing it without identifying themselves, which is more likely to give them a better or more comfortable feeling to share that information. The CDC does this YRBS every other year in Wisconsin. And we will get from the CDC, they ask us to work, they identify samples in different schools to get statewide data. But on the other off year, schools can do their own YRBS. We have an online system that they can sign up to do, middle school through high school. And then they can get their own school's data to do that. That data is very powerful for this because it can also disaggregate that. By that I mean you're able to look at the students that are reporting being bullied by gender, racial and ethnic background, LGBTQ. It's one of the few measures we have where students can identify whether they belong to, or they identify themselves in that group. And those kinds of disaggregated data provide a better opportunity for us to intervene in a way that's going to be effective, as opposed to just a blanket 24%.
Talking to Beth Herman from the Department of Public Instruction, talking about bullying in schools, how we measure bullying and trends long term, and what we can do with that information. And Beth, you mentioned trying to figure out interventions. Do we have enough data to be able to measure, okay, if we try this program in this school, is it making a difference?
Depends on the program. So, in 2010, I believe, was when the bill passed for the bullying prevention law, which essentially said districts had to have a policy in place and that DPI had to do a model policy. And we do have a curriculum at the high school level that DPI created because there are very few at that level. But what we recommend is that districts use programs that are considered evidence-based. Schools know that language. They're familiar with it. These are programs that have actually been tested through generally peer-reviewed studies to indicate if done with fidelity or the way the program is designed that there should be an outcome. Once they're using an evidence-based program, schools can also then collect data to see if things are making an impact. One of the things I think people don't always understand, though, is that when you start a program, you're not going to see those big ticket items change right away. So the first couple years that you're doing these interventions, you may not see bullying reduce. And in fact, you may get the opposite, where it appears to increase because more people know what it is and are now reporting it or identifying it on those surveys. But you would start to see things like improvements in connection to adults in the building or other climate sorts of measures. So when you look at any kind of intervention, it's a long-term process.
Looking at the data that we have, do we know how we're doing in Wisconsin when it comes to the amount of bullying that happens?
I think that CDC, that comes out every 2 years, is our best indicator. And, you know, when they say 24% of students are reporting that, that's pretty consistent with what we know. That data also does disaggregate. So we can get a pretty good picture in the state of Wisconsin how our students in different groups feel. Are girls feeling that they're more bullied than boys? Are our LGBT students indicating that there's a greater degree of bullying? We can get a statewide picture. We can't do. I can't tell you what a certain district is doing or their certain data. That is up to them to collect what they do and what they do with that data. That's entirely up to them.
We've heard from some of our listeners on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to run a few of their comments by you. Travis, first of all, says bullying is part of life. And I think there's a fairly common attitude. This is kids. Some people get bullied and they grow out of it eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, if you start to address it, I haven't seen any study or any program that completely gets rid of it. However, we do know that very consistent, frequent bullying has significant impacts, not just on the kids that get bullied, but also the kids who engage in the bullying. Hmm. Both of them are at greater risk for mental health concerns. Both of them are at greater risk for school difficulties and academic achievement problems. So it has a huge impact. So yes, it is very prevalent, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't respond.
John Paul writes, bullying has always been an issue, but when he was a kid, violence was never followed up on. John Paul says, at least now there is action and parents have resources to deal with it. So are we taking this problem more seriously than we might have a generation or two ago?
Anecdotally, from my experience, I would say definitely. And, you know, the degree to which people are responding and the types of responses are going to vary among communities. Schools have the authority to create their own intervention programs. But it's the awareness is raised for families as well as school personnel. People are looking for it. They're recognizing it more. And I think just acknowledging for students who have been bullied that it is a pretty significant experience for them has made a difference.
And we also heard from Pamela. Pamela writes that she knows of at least two students who were bullied in local schools. Their parents ultimately had to pull them out because it wasn't addressed. And I'm sure there are parents probably listening right now who have been through a similar situation. Is there support available for parents and families who feel that their bullying situation hasn't been addressed properly by their school?
There is limited support in that we can work with from the DPI. We manage a lot of calls like this where parents want to know what to do. But ultimately, the authority lies in the school board. The way the current legislation is set up and as a local control state, there isn't any recourse that they have from the State Department, for example. And we can coach them and work with them on how to do that. I would say that sometimes schools aren't very good about sharing what they are doing and how they are trying to manage it. And sometimes it appears that things aren't being done. And there are any number of situations that are occurring in schools that can make this a difficult problem to address. There is legislation that does allow families, however, to move their children to another school through an open enrollment process outside of the typical standard enrollment time for four conditions. So any time during the year, a parent can request an open enrollment. And one of those four conditions is bullying. So they do have that option.
That's the parent side of things. If there are people out there listening who work with the schools and are thinking, yeah, we could up our game on this, what kind of resources are out there to help them?
So on our website, we've created a comprehensive bully prevention assessment tool so that schools can see what it actually takes. There's a lot more to this. It's a complex problem. People have been looking at this for a very long time. And, you know, there are any number of things besides a curriculum that schools need to do. And part of it is training all staff on what it is and to recognize it. So on our website, we have that tool so schools can sit down and see kind of where they're currently at, what they're doing well, and what they need some support on. And then each of those sections of that assessment tool, there are resources that schools could use. So examples about how they might do investigations of bullying reports or report forms or how they communicate to parents about what's happening or what their policy and their procedures are. So there are resources on there for them to do that.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Beth, as you just said, there's no one magic solution to bullying. But if one change could be made, one priority could be set to help, what would you like to see?
You know, I think when schools focus on creating a climate where students feel welcome, families feel welcome, and adults and students build strong bonds and relationships, you're going to create an environment where bullying just cannot happen all that easily. So it's creating the environment where the types of actions that are bullying actions, the gossip, the threats, the using your power to control somebody else, just is not going to be an option because the environment doesn't allow it.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Beth Herman, education consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's Student Services Prevention and Wellness Team. She joined us today to talk about tracking data on bullying in Wisconsin schools. Coming up, we'll look at the challenges facing Governor Evers' pledge to cut the state's prison population in half. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, under the Trump administration, the U.S. Agriculture Department has backed off publicizing research on the effects of climate change on agriculture. We'll find out what kind of studies aren't making their way to the public and to farmers in particular. First, Governor Evers says he remains committed to his plan to cut Wisconsin's prison population in half. In an interview with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, he said he believes offenders deserve a second chance, and he also says he wants to focus more on alternative programs to keep people out of prison. It's proving to be a tall order. For one thing, his proposed budget would add prison beds. He's also pushed back a deadline to close two youth prisons in northern Wisconsin. And some measures, such as shortening sentences, would require the cooperation of judges and the Republican-led legislature. Wisconsin's prison population is expected to reach an all-time high of 25,000 in 2 years. The prison system is also running 33% over capacity, with understaffing at many facilities. Dee Hall is the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, good to have you back.
All right. Thanks for having me.
What have we seen since Governor Evers took office on how he's trying to tackle this pledge to lower the state's prison population?
Well, he does stick by the 50% reduction, but one thing he has done is not put a time frame on that. So he's trying to he's avoiding that problem. His early budget, his budget proposal was actually criticized by some inmate advocates as not going far enough toward this goal of 50% reduction. And as you mentioned, it actually calls for some additional beds into state prisons, Tichita and Jackson Correctional. So those have been the source of some controversy. He also did not go as far as some advocates wanted him to go when it came to these treatment and diversion programs that keep people out of prison. So those are areas where I think, he's been criticized. On the other side, though, he is looking at and did tell us that he's looking at a certain kind of release, which has rarely been used, which allows the Department of Corrections Secretary to release prisoners in the event of overcrowding.
Let's look at what's in a governor's toolkit as opposed to what he would have to have the legislature say to help him out with. What kind of powers could the governor use to tackle this without that outside support?
So one thing he could do, he says he's not going to direct his new parole commission chairman to increase the number of releases, but he's really signaled that that's the direction he would like to see the parole commission go. And so that's one thing, is increasing paroles. Right now we're talking about single digits of people who are being accepted for parole. The biggest proposal that he talked about was reducing or eliminating crimeless revocations. That's another thing that he could do. Right now, 40% of all the people who are admitted to Wisconsin state prisons are actually there for violating rules and not committing new crimes. So that's a huge driver of prison growth. And of course, I mentioned the early release program, the DOC secretary. That's like a 30-year-old law that has rarely been invoked. But that's something that they are looking at, that he and his administration are looking at. The inmates who would be released would have to be not serving a life sentence, not there for assault of crimes, and they would have to be within 18 months of their mandatory release date.
Let's look at that revocation issue. Now, this is somebody's out of prison, but they have to follow a certain set of rules. And often, as you were saying, they end up back in prison because they violate a rule. That violation, though, isn't a new crime. And I've talked to prison reform advocates who say that is a big problem in Wisconsin.
Well, what happens is in Wisconsin, we have one of the highest lengths of supervision time of any state in the country. We're about double the national average. On average, a person on supervision out in the community is under that watch for 3 years and 2 months. So that's in that 66,000 people in the state are under various conditions. And the reason that we had stated that this could actually lengthen sentences rather than reduce them is the example given by a member of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which studied this. For example, if a person's on 3 years of extended supervision and on the last day of extended supervision violates a rule, could be sent back to prison for the entire term, the entire 3 years of the supervision. Now, that doesn't usually happen, but that's an example of what can happen and how a person who maybe is on a year of extended supervision could end up spending even longer than that incarcerated.
Talking in D. Hall with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, a new piece looks at Governor Evers' pledge to cut Wisconsin's prison population and the challenges to doing that. Let's look at Wisconsin's truth in sentencing law. D., how does that work and how did that affect the prison population?
So truth in sentencing started at in the beginning of the year 2000. And what happened there, people were tired of somebody being sentenced to 40 years in prison. And when in fact, they would only serve 10 years for sure, and two-thirds of that and then they would be released mandatorily unless something happened in the meantime, some kind of incident within the prison. And so people were like, let's just have truth in sentencing. Like if I say you're 20 years and 10 years you're going to be confined and 10 years you're going to be on supervision, that's what it's going to be. And early releases are very rare under very rare conditions. And so that's the system we have now. What happened back then was there was supposed to be a companion reduction of maximum sentences, and that did not happen. So what's happening now is the length of sentences is longer. That means more people are in prison for long. It means people are in prison for longer. And so that's one of the biggest drivers of our prison population increase.
And that is something that Governor Evers could not tackle single-handedly.
Right. So the things that he can't really do, he can't cut maximum sentences. That is a job of the legislature if they decide to do that. And that would include any changes to the truth in sentencing law. He cannot reduce already imposed sentences. That's up to a judge. You can go back to a judge and ask for that to happen. But the statistics show it rarely is granted. And he also can't unilaterally put more money into treatment and diversion programs. That's something, again, that the legislature has the power to do because they allocate money. So, for example, he had proposed up to $4 million more per year, adding to the existing $6 million that the state is spending on these programs. The legislature decided, no, $1 million per year is enough.
There is some interest, it sounds like, from Republican lawmakers. You talked to at least one Republican lawmaker in this piece, maybe not for this exact change, but there is some interest in working with the governor on this.
Yes, I would say that's true for certain things, especially the diversion programs. I think people recognize the value of those, that they're cost effective and they're effective in general. And so we are seeing some interest in that from the Republican legislature.
Now, a related issue that shows how hard it can be to change things, we mentioned Governor Walker signed the bill that would close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the youth prisons in northern Wisconsin, by 2021. That looks like it's going to take longer to do, to replace that with smaller, more local facilities.
Right. So all of these things have a variety of consequences. It's easy to say I'd like to cut the prison population by 50%. It's harder to get everybody else to go along with that. And in the last 8 years, for example, there's been very little appetite in the Republican-controlled legislature to even look at reducing prison populations very specifically. That was not really much of a topic among the lawmakers over the past two gubernatorial terms.
At the national level, though, there has been a kind of a strange alliance between people on the left and the right, conservative groups joining calls for prison reform to lower the number of inmates. Talking to the people you talked to, do you get a sense that people are more open to those ideas than they were, say, 10 years ago?
I think so. I think 10 years ago, I remember doing stories about, you know, efforts to try to reduce the prison population under Governor Doyle. And those, even then, those, it was a tall order. But you have seen individuals and powerful institutions like the Koch brothers, for example, come in and say, look, we need to stop locking up so many people. We incarcerate per person almost more than any other country in the world. And they're having some real consequences aside from community dysfunction and people being in prison. You also have the issue of people aren't available to work. You know, the labor shortage, one piece of it is there's so many people who are locked up that they can't get enough people to fill jobs.
We'll leave it there for now. Dee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Dee Hall, managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We talked through about some of the challenges facing Governor Evers and his pledge to cut the state's prison population in half. He talked about that on the campaign trail last year. Right now, the prison system is running 33% above capacity. Wisconsin is on pace to house 25,000 inmates by the year 2021. You can share your thoughts, maybe your experiences with the state's corrections system on either side of it. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think about the idea of trying to cut the state's overall prison population over the next few years. Have you seen any PG-13 movies lately? That rating exists thanks to an announcement made 35 years ago today, and it's all thanks to Indiana Jones. On this day in 1984, the Motion Picture Association of America announced the creation of a new category in their movie rating system, the PG-13. So why? Before that, you had G, PG, R, and X. G was general audiences, anybody can see that. X was basically porn, or pretty close to porn, grown-ups only. PG was parental guidance. Kids can watch it. Parents should think about it. And R was restricted. The kids can't get in without a grown-up. But there was some gray area there, especially when it came to the PG and the R. The movie that finally broke the system was the Raiders of the Lost Ark sequel, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. It was rated PG, but it had a lot of intense violence and gruesome stuff and some torture and, you know, hearts being ripped out. And some parents came out of that one pretty angry and kids maybe a little bit traumatized. A lot of people at the time said the movie should have had an R rating. Now, Steven Spielberg, he co-created the series with George Lucas. He said, no, not R, but how about an intermediate rating between PG and R? The result was the PG-13 rating for films with, quote, a higher level of intensity. A few months later, the first PG-13 movie came out. It was Red Dawn, starring Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.